Hi everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Haunted History Chronicles, a place where we dive deep into the history and the haunted history of some pretty amazing locations around the world. In this episode, we're going to be exploring a rather impressive Grade 2 listed building situated in Hereford, in England. So without further ado, let's get started. The building itself was first given approval to be built in 1815 by Act of Parliament, so as to provide suitable accommodations for His Majesty's justices to dispense justice in and around the area of Hereford. The Shire Hall itself was designed by Charles Heather under the instruction of Sir Robert Smirk, a renowned English architect and considered a leader in Greek Revival architecture. He designed several public buildings, including the main block and facade of the British Museum. The building was completed in 1817 on what had previously been the local jail. The principal rooms were made up of a great hall, a grand jury room, a library, and some court rooms. The front of the building itself faced St. Peter's Square and featured Doric columns supporting a frieze with triglyphs and a pediment, very much in keeping with Greek early architecture. Although the original purpose of the building was to dispense justice, in 1888, the Local Government Act would implement and establish county councils in every county in England. And so the Shire Hall would continue to be used as a court, but also serve as a meeting place for the newly formed Herefordshire County Council. Now, the building has continued to hold Crown Court hearings and meetings to this day, making it one of the oldest working courtrooms in England. Many of the original features remain, including that of a hook, used by the judge when sentencing people to death, prior to them being transported to St. Peter's Square, where the execution would be carried out. Many reports exist from hanging towns up and down the country of people being mishandled prior to and after death. Compared to their European counterparts, English executioners lacked basic medical expertise to ensure a quick death on the gallows. Nor were anatomists consulted as to best placement or length of the rope. Nor was the weight of the prisoner itself factored in. All too often, the rope would slip or be tied incorrectly around the voice box, leading to the prisoner being unable to scream or cry out. It would, however, prolong their death. There are many uncomfortable reports of people being cut down after the maximum hour of hanging time had been reached, to find the prisoner still with their neck unbroken, writhing in excruciating pain. They would be hemorrhaging in the brain from the build-up of the pressure there. The brain itself would have started to turn to a mush. The visible signs of this happening included eyes protruding, the face turning from vivid purple to black. Both were often reported in provincial newspapers at the time. The criminal was in the most confusing medical state of all, the living dead. And it was now that the executioner had the discretion to make concessions to appease the crowd. The Capital Code decreed that the hangman did not have the option of using a sword or dagger to finish off the criminal. That penal authority had been revoked as uncivilised by the early modern period. It was routine, however, to find other ways to speed things up, something that would become known as a rough-handled body by the surgeons who would go on to perform their dissections on the corpses for medical science. Many people would pass through these courts. In a celebrated case at the time, a solicitor, Herbert Armstrong, was tried and convicted of murdering his wife in April of 1922. He remains the only solicitor in the history of the United Kingdom to have been hanged for murder. The prosecution case was a strong one. Catherine Armstrong's body was riddled with arsenic, and at the time of her death, the ingested quantity must have been far higher. Herbert Armstrong had been making huge purchases of arsenic in the lead-up to her death. The defence had somehow to make the jury believe that Mrs. Armstrong had committed suicide by getting out of bed, going downstairs, and helping herself to arsenic without anyone seeing or hearing her, or that massive doses of arsenic had somehow got into her system in some accidental way. Something seemingly impossible when all witnesses of the day confirmed that towards the end of her life, she was almost paralysed. However, despite the evidence against Armstrong being considerable, it was nonetheless purely circumstantial. No one had actually seen him administering the poison, and at the time of his arrest he'd made no attempt to draw upon his dead wife's fortune. Mrs. Armstrong had occasionally spoken of suicide. Some medicines of the day contained arsenic, and there were plenty of other people coming into contact with her. The prosecution failed to show how it was Armstrong, and only Armstrong who administered poison, and no one else. Armstrong made no confession, and adamantly maintained his total innocence to the bitter end. It is claimed by some who were there the day of his execution that his final words were, "Kitty, I'm coming to ye." Another famous case was that of Alfred Watkins, who was hanged in 1864 after also confessing to the murder of his wife. At the time, he was also convicted of the murder of two other men, a crime he never admitted to. Both of these figures are believed to haunt this building. Many claim, for example, that Alfred returns to try and clear himself of the murders of the two men that he continued to maintain that he had nothing to do with. With so many reports of ill treatment, it's no surprise that Shire Hall has reports of paranormal activity. Dark, shadowy figures have been seen normally preceding a foul smell, and feelings of anxiety by many in the old courtrooms and cells. Feelings of lightheadedness and nausea have been experienced by many in the building, and figures and dismembered voices heard crying and wailing out. I visited here a few years ago. It's a place I enjoyed exploring enormously, as it was very different to the usual types of buildings that I had been to up until that point. It was here too, though, I would try out some different types of investigations that I will talk about in this podcast. The building itself is somewhat misleading from the front, as it appears to be smaller than it actually is. It is quite extensive with many levels. From the older courtrooms in the centre of those rooms are the docks. From there you can descend below to the prison cells that are where the prisoners would have been detained and brought up for trial. The courtrooms themselves, as you can imagine, have that very austere feel to them. The cells below are small. The feeling of claustrophobia is strong. These stone cells are below ground. The air is stagnant, and there are no windows or natural light of any kind. The evening began as a big group in the grand large hall, which featured a stage at one end, a very atmospheric room. From here we would move on to one of the two original courtrooms, which still has its original panelling. From there we would descend via the very narrow and steep staircase to the cells below. Despite the occasional tapping noises and minor knocking sounds, I can't say that anything of note happened in any of these areas whilst I was there. It felt very quiet too. I didn't sense anything, and no equipment really picked up anything. After this, people would move off into small groups or alone to carry out their own investigations or smaller group vigils. I went on to spend a good part of the rest of the evening in two different locations. One of these was a large room with Victorian pieces inside, cabinets and large tables and seats, a beautiful fireplace and large windows. I will share, as always, some photographs from some of the different locations mentioned thus far on my social media pages. In this particular room, I would set up light sensors that covered pretty much the entirety of the room itself. Now, obviously, we were hoping to capture something that would disturb the sensors and cause a break in the lights that you could see lighting up all the walls and furniture. The equipment is incredibly sensitive. Something very small, a moth fluttering for example, will create a distortion that you see in the light patterns displayed. Something larger will obviously create a much bigger distortion. We sat in one spot throughout, and nobody else came into that room to disturb what we were doing. Partway through this small vigil, the light would distort quite significantly near what was a large cabinet in the room. It was so clear, something large in size comparable to that of something stood in that area. Then the lights would return to normal with no break in the light patterns. I wish I'd had something to continuously capture it on video, because it was so clear. Taking photographs as a run of pictures meant I just missed it. It was that quick. To myself, though, and the others in the room, it was very clearly something. Something had broken the light sensors, and it could not have been us. We would try for quite some time after this to ask and call out for something similar to happen in the room, but it became quiet after that. The last room of the night is where I would try something I had never tried before, with just one other person, and that was the act of scrying using a large jet black obsidian mirror. Scrying is known by many other names. Hydromancy, crystal gazing are just a few. In essence, though, is simply the ancient art of revelation. It is the practice of looking into a suitable medium in the hope of detecting a significant message or vision. The word scrying actually comes from the Old English word descry, which means to make out dimly or to reveal. Therefore, scrying is about revealing the unseen through the use of our inborn second sight. Second sight is our capacity to see things that can't usually be perceived through our five senses. Traditionally, scrying has been portrayed through the popular image of the psychic gazing over her crystal ball. Almost every culture has used some form of scrying, from the Native Americans' observation of smoke, to the Egyptians' use of oil gazing to gain wisdom. Usually, scrying is performed with the use of a reflective surface, such as a mirror, water, or crystal. However, there are many other forms. The nine most common types are wax, oil, fire, water, cloud, mirror, smoke, crystal, and eye. When you hear what is involved, you can see that in many cases, these are things that you often may have done yourself or seen someone doing. Scrying using an eye may seem unusual. It is also called soul gazing. This form of scrying involves looking deep within a person's eyes and observing the reflections. The crystal is the stereotypical form of scrying, but nonetheless very effective. It involves the use of a crystal object, usually a ball or globe, to gather special meaning. The use of fire is possibly the most ancient form of scrying. This type of scrying involves gazing into fiery flames for visions. This can be done through the use of a simple candle, or oil lamp, or of course something bigger. Scrying using smoke involves gazing into the smoke as it rises from the fire. Its ethereal shapes present messages. Scrying with water involves staring into water and hoping that images can be perceived after some time. Objects such as pebbles can also be dropped into the water to create ripples, which themselves can then be interpreted. The use of a mirror is possibly the most popular form of scrying. It involves relaxing your vision and staring into a mirror. After a while, images and scenes will begin to emerge. The use of wax is done by dripping wax onto a water surface. The scryer then interprets the images or words formed from the dry wax. Cloud scrying, also called cloud gazing, is simply the form of scrying involving observing clouds and the shapes that they form, in the hopes of gathering some kind of special information or knowledge. The very last form of scrying is with oil. It involves pouring oil into a dish, rubbing it onto the body, or coating a cup or plate with it. The scryer then observes the light reflected off the oil for information. So as I mentioned, I tried scrying with a dark mirror, as did the person I was with. I went first, and remember this was my first experience scrying. I relaxed and started staring into the mirror. I have no concept as to how long I remained like that. I really did get lost in the process of scrying itself. It's a strange sensation, one that I will try and explain in terms of what happened over the next few minutes. So, just listening to this podcast, you can probably work out that I'm female. If I were to pick out some of my facial details for you, I would explain that I have a very clear female nose. It's small and narrow, probably narrower and smaller than many women's, in fact. I have very long dark hair, and at the time it was down and hanging around both sides of my neck. I also have quite a narrow head, and it often means that I've been able to get away with wearing children's glasses for my frames, because adult frames tend to be too big and need to be manipulated in order to fit my facial shape. I say all of this because what happened over those few minutes was to see my nose broaden quite considerably, in particular at the base, and at the top it almost appeared flatter. My hair almost faded out, leaving me with a considerably shorter haircut and something that was very, very thick. My face literally became more masculine before my very eyes. I knew it was me I was staring at, but at the same time I did not recognise myself at all. My glasses had also gone. When I describe this to you, I want you to understand that as I recount this, the hairs on my arms are literally standing up. This event really did leave an impact on me. Staring at the face, it looked familiar, but I couldn't place it at all. It was on the tip of my tongue, but I couldn't take that next step to recognise what I was seeing. But I knew that the face was one that disturbed me. Not just because of the fact that seeing someone else's reflection looking back at you is a bit startling. The eyes were what transfixed me. They were narrow and mean and dark, dead eyes, almost appearing sunken and close together. About all I could say was that I felt I was looking into evil and it was staring back at me. It really was unnerving. I didn't go into scrying with any expectations that anything would happen. Probably, honestly, the opposite. I went into it thinking that the likelihood of seeing anything would be slim and probably down to tiredness or my mind creating images and playing tricks. That face, though, is still clear in my mind all these years later, and the feeling it left me with. Only one word. Evil. I will come back to this part of the story a little bit later. The person I was with got given that mirror after that. I didn't want to continue with it because, quite honestly, it had pushed me outside of my comfort zone. I really did feel unsettled. As she began, her face also began to change in the mirror. The feeling, though, was so very different to the experience I just had. Her face would broaden and age. Between the two of us, we would describe what we were seeing. It was something that felt very comforting. Partway through her scrying, something came into my head, a word, that I couldn't repeat to this day. It was a name in Welsh, a name I had never heard up until then or since. I don't speak Welsh at all, but yet this name came to me and I was able to say it out loud. Now, the person I was with became emotional. That name had a particular reference for her that I won't share, but it was also one that I didn't know anything about. She would later show me pictures of her grandmother, and my goodness, it sure looked like the face I'd seen and described. And that name? One maybe that came through from her grandmother to say that soul was with her and okay. It was really touching, as I said, comforting, and the total opposite of what I'd experienced, and something that I would not have been able to describe or know about without something connecting with me at that point in the evening. To conclude, let's return to that face I saw and felt. It stayed with me for weeks, knowing it and just not being able to place it. I spent a while searching and trying to find records of who it could have been, something not easy to do when there aren't a great deal of public records, and certainly more difficult when you don't know where to start. As soon as I mention the following name, I'm sure it will be one many of you are familiar with. Fred West. He is an English serial killer that committed at least 12 murders between 1967 and 1987. All of his victims were young women, and many of these were later found concealed in his house and garden. He killed himself by asphyxiation in 1995, whilst on remand in prison awaiting trial. This was well over a decade before I would go to Shire Hall in Hereford. And at the time of Fred West's arrest, it's something I remember, but nothing in huge detail. I was probably 15 or 16 at the time. I had no idea of any connection he had with this building, and I'm sure many don't. The building itself had nothing to do with his later arrests, but the face I saw was undoubtedly him when I saw it again. And when I made the connection with his link to Shire Hall, it all fell into place and made sense. In June of 1961, Fred was arrested for the molestation of his 13-year-old sister and tried on the 9th of November in the very building. Fred's mother was prepared to give evidence, but Kitty, his sister, could not and refused. The case collapsed in court. Post that, he was effectively disowned by his family and would go on to commit the later crimes that he did with his wife. He was the face of evil that I saw and the evil that I felt to my core. Thank you for listening, everyone. If you are someone interested in the paranormal, maybe try scrying at a location you visit or in your own home. Like I said during this podcast, it really is an ancient art. If you have any first-hand experiences, let me know. You can get in touch through the social media pages for the podcast, but linked into every episode description is a means to also send me a digitally recorded message. Until next week, bye for now, everyone. So I have a really special announcement to also make. I have been busy over the Christmas holidays building a new website for Haunted History Chronicles. It's still a work in progress, but I would love you to go over to there, have a look. It has a lot of different new features, ones that I hope you'll be able to engage with and enjoy. I will put the new description for that website into the description box below so that you can access it. I'd love to see you over there. If you like this podcast, you can help in different ways. Come and join us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Help spread the word with friends and family. Share the news of the podcast with other people that may be interested. Down in the description box below is also an access to Patreon, where you can continue to support the podcast further and in the process gain access to some extra goodies. If you ever get the time to write a review, I'd really appreciate it. Thank you so much, everyone.